I ran out of whatever little money I'd brought with me from India, and to take care of my living expenses in the US, I did not want to sell even a single stock from my portfolio because I did not want to interrupt the process of compounding. So I took up a minimum wage job as a front desk clerk at a hotel in San Francisco, where I worked for 15 months in the graveyard shift. And even though it was a very big challenge for me, intellectually, mentally, physically, emotionally, and culturally, in hindsight today, I highly value those days of my life because for the first time since the beginning of my busy investment banking career, I finally got some time for myself to read and learn.
Welcome to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. How to make it, save it, keep it. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. My guests share their practices, principles, and evergreen wisdom. I'm your host, Bogumil Baranowski, author, TEDx speaker, investor, and a founding partner of Sicard Associates, a boutique investment firm founded in New York City. Join me on this quest to unearth the wisdom of the ages. My guest today is Gautam Bate. He's the managing partner and fund manager of Stellar Wealth Partners India Fund. The fund is modeled after the Buffett Partnership and invests in listed Indian equities with a long-term fundamental and value-oriented approach. Previously, Gautam served as portfolio manager at Summit Global Investments. Before that, he served at the Mumbai, London, and Hong Kong offices of Citigroup and Deutsche Bank as senior analyst in their investment banking teams. Gautam is the author of the international bestseller on value investing, The Joys of Compounding. He's a CFA charter holder and has an MBA in finance from Nirma University, India, and a master's in science in finance from ICFAI University, India. Gautam's views and opinions have been published on various forums in print, digital, and social media. In 2018 and 2019, he was profiled in Morningstar's Learn From the Master series. We will talk about Gautam's journey from India to the United States and his passion for investing, the importance of reading and writing in the investing success, why value investing principles are timeless, the attitude towards material wealth, the nature and benefits of delayed gratification, luck, chance, serendipity, randomness, and their role in our lives and investing, the notion that you can borrow someone's investment idea, but you cannot borrow their conviction. Thoughts on investing in India. Gautam is an avid reader, and if you're still wanting more after the interview and the book, as I was, I highly recommend browsing through his reading list that he shares on his website and Goodreads. I have read more books than I remember, but in his list, I found a few dozen that I have never heard of, and I immediately added them to my list. Please help me welcome Gautam Bate. Hello, dear listener. I have a small favor to ask. If you're enjoying the show, please follow, subscribe, and most of all, share with everyone that would like it too. It's all word of mouth marketing. It's all up to your fingertips to make a small contribution and become an important part of the success of the show. Thank you. Gautam, nice to have you on the show.
Thank you, Bogumil. It's a pleasure.
As you know, I'm a big fan of your book, The Joys of Compounding, The Passionate Pursuit of Lifelong Learning. And I have a lot of questions for you, so thank you for joining me today. I always like to start with my guests from the beginning. And as I mentioned to you, and I hope you don't mind, I'd be curious to hear more about your childhood, your upbringing, and your path all the way to writing the book and starting an investment fund that we briefly talked about, and your journey from India all the way to the US. If you can walk me through some of the highlights, how did you end up being such a passionate person about compounding and investing? And then we'll talk more about the book itself.
Sure. So I was born and brought up in a family of four in the city of Kolkata in India. And my father was a small business owner. So ever since my early teenage years, I was very fascinated by the concept of business and entrepreneurship, especially by the fact that once a solid foundation has been established for a business, the owners do not work for money. Rather, money works for them. I did my graduation in commerce with a specialization in accountancy, so pursuing higher studies in the field of finance seemed like a natural extension. I did my MBA in finance from Nirmal University, Ahmedabad, India, and I did my MS in finance from ICFA University, Hyderabad, India. Later on, I also went on to obtain my charter from the CFA Institute. After I got done with my MBA program, I got a campus placement with Citibank at their Mumbai office in India, where I worked in the investment banking department. And after working in Citibank for 3 years, I went to join Deutsche Bank, where I worked as a senior analyst in their investment banking team for almost 4 years at their Mumbai, London, and Hong Kong offices. Now, all throughout the first 7 years of my investing career, I was very passionate about investing in the stock market in general. And let me give you a brief background about how I got started in the world of investing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as is typically the story of most investors in the market, I was attracted to the stock market towards the final euphoric phases of a roaring bull market. In my case, it was the 2003 to 2007 bull market in India.
Mm-hmm.
I still remember I had purchased a mutual fund called Reliance Power Sector Mutual Fund and a stock named Ispat Steel in late 2007 and early 2008, because both of these were in the hot and fancied sectors of power and steel at the time. And both these investments had very sharply gone up in a very short span of time when I'd first noticed them. So I just blindly extrapolated the recent price trends in them without paying any attention whatsoever to their valuations or underlying business models.
Mm-hmm.
And I eventually paid the price like most investors do. Recency and vividness biases are very powerful but highly costly behavioral mistakes. Both those investments crashed 70 to 80% within the first 12 months of my purchase, and I had successfully gained admission into the stock markets by paying my tuition fees. Now, despite this bad initial experience, my enthusiasm and curiosity about the stock markets remained very high. And after working in the investment banking field for 7 years, one fine day I came to the realization that we just have this one short life to live our dreams, and I did not want to waste any further time doing something that I was not truly passionate about. The problem with many people in the world today is that they equate happiness with having a very high income or making more money. But that's not the reality beyond a point. You know, true happiness is when you're living a life which is aligned with your personal value system. That is when you actually achieve fulfillment and true happiness. So I was so keen for a career shift from the private investment banking side to the public side of stock markets that I relocated to the US in 2015. My relative is an American citizen. He sponsored my green card. I relocated to the US without any job in hand. So, and I was under the impression that since I'm a CFA charter holder,
mm-hmm.
and since this particular degree is highly valued in the investment industry, I will easily land a stock market job very easily. But as you know, life mm-hmm. is not a bed of roses for those trying to carve their own destiny. I got rejected in my first 3 stock market job interviews within the first 6 months of coming to the US, but I did not give up. I was very firm and adamant that I'm not going to go back to my previous field of investment banking, where the presence of perverse incentives constantly led to incentive cost bias and conflicts of interest, and did not suit my personal nature. At the same time, I ran out of whatever little money I'd brought with me from India, and to take care of my living expenses in the US, I did not want to sell even a single stock from my portfolio of Indian equities because I did not want to interrupt the process of compounding. So I took up a minimum wage job as a front desk clerk at a hotel in San Francisco, where I worked for 15 months in the graveyard shift. Now, for those of you who don't know what the graveyard shift means, it's a shift which runs from 11 p.m. at night to 7 a.m. in the morning. And even though it was a very big challenge for me, intellectually, mentally, physically, emotionally, and culturally, in hindsight today, I highly value those days of my life because for the first time since the beginning of my busy investment banking career, I finally got some time for myself to read and learn. The pace of work at the hotel from late night to early morning was pretty slow, and I made full use of the free time to read every single blog article published on blogs like Safal Niveshak, Janav WordPress, Macrocap Club, Fundu Professor, Basit Investing, among others. And the passionate pursuit of lifelong learning had finally begun. Now, at this stage, I would like to briefly talk with you about the power of passion. I still remember every night during those 15 months at the hotel, I used to apply to a minimum of 3 stock market jobs online. And as you know, every single time we take out time to fill out the job application, attach our resume, and every single time we click the submit button, there is so much hope attached behind every single submission. over those 15 months, if you just do the basic math, I had applied to more than 1,300 stock market jobs in the US. Now, to face rejection more than 1,300 times and still keep on going is only possible if you're ferociously passionate about what you want to do in life. And the key to compounding is to not give up. It is to keep at it. And you never know when you're not going to make it big. That is the big thing which I want to share here, that compounding will bestow its benefits and magic upon you only after testing your patience and conviction to the fullest. Now, luck, chance, serendipity, and randomness have always played a big role in various aspects of my life till date. During November 2016, during one fine night at the hotel, I just clicked on the quick apply button on a job application on LinkedIn during the course of my routine online job search. And wonder of wonders, I was shortlisted for the interview, and that too for a senior role in an investment firm, even though I had zero formal stock market work experience. And this was the phase in my life during which I was about to realize the power of compounding knowledge in action. You see, all those hundreds of hours spent over the previous 15 months at the hotel reading all those blog articles and white papers had now established a very strong intellectual foundation for me in investing. And this time I was able to excel in all the three rounds of my job interview. Because as you know, body language derives from confidence and confidence derives from knowledge. And I was offered the role of a portfolio manager of global equity strategy with Summit Global Investments in Salt Lake City, Utah, where I worked as a portfolio manager for 4.5 years. It was like a dream come true for me. I never thought I'll straight away land the job of a portfolio manager. I thought I'll be hired as a junior analyst, then get promoted to analyst, then to senior analyst, then to assistant portfolio manager, and then to portfolio manager after a total of 12-15 years. But this is the magic of compounding and persistence at play. After tracking global stock markets for 4.5 years in Summit Global, I came to the realization that India as a country, as a stock market destination, very clearly stood out to me for the number of high growth opportunities it offered. So I stepped down from my role in July 2021, 1.5 years ago, and I started work on establishing my own India fund in the US. We started operations 5 months ago. Yeah, basically the true happiness in life is, you know, basically when work does not seem like work, work seems like play. That is where I find myself in today. And finally, as regards the book, now this is again a very interesting background story for the book. So in November 2016, I had joined Twitter for the first time and I started posting whatever thoughts were coming to my head on different fields and subjects, be it psychology, philosophy, history, investing, economics. And within a few months of me joining Twitter, two people flew all the way from India to Salt Lake City in USA to meet me and thank me for what I was posting. And they were the ones who recommended to me the idea of why don't you write a book, post such good thoughts on Twitter. Now, you know, Steve Jobs has often said that you cannot connect the dots looking forward, you can only connect the dots looking backward. I had a habit of always documenting my thoughts in a Word document and also maintaining an archive of the very good articles that I've read over the years. And I just thought, okay, this seems like a good idea and a good way to give back to the investing community. Let me simply self-publish this book out of my own pocket and not charge any royalty. This is just a goodwill gesture to help to give back to the investing community. So I self-published my learnings and thoughts into a book called The Joys of Compounding. And that self-published book did so well that, you know, later that same year, Columbia University Press from New York actually offered me a publishing agreement with them. And since Columbia Business School is where value investing originated, that is where Benjamin Graham used to teach. So that's right. All of us investors have a dream to work with Columbia on a book someday. And here, one more dream was getting realized and fulfilled. So the rest is history. After that, The Joys of Compounding went on to become an international bestseller in 6 countries worldwide and has gotten a lot of love and admiration from readers. In fact, I tell my wife that my real wealth is not the money which I've made from investing in the Indian stock market. It is these letters and emails from readers around the world. That is my true treasure. That is my true wealth. Life is good and I hope to continue in this lifelong learning journey. That is the true journey of a value investor.
I love it. And it's a wonderful book. And I didn't realize that at first you were giving it out for free. I came across your book a while ago and I found myself rereading it the last few weeks as we scheduled this recording. And it was fun to see the same ideas with fresh eyes. And the book is so rich. And I have to recommend it to everybody curious about investing to just explore this book. And it's a book that you have to digest each chapter, each page at a time. And I found myself highlighting so many things that I told you before this call that There are so many things I want to talk about, and I have to cherry pick a few so we don't spend the whole day. But I want to talk about a couple of things that you just mentioned. Number one for me is the mistakes. You started off in the investment profession or investing for yourself, and you lost money at first. And it's so important, I think, for a lot of people on their path to become successful investors. Whenever I give talks about investing, I always ask the whole room, and then I ask them about the first stock that they bought. Did they lose money or did they make money on the very first stock they bought? And I lost money on my very first stock. It was an airline. And I always find it really interesting. Can you tell me more about it? The idea that you lose money on the initial investments, that experience shapes you in a certain way as you continue as an investor, because there are quite a few people that are so successful initially, they think it's easy and then they get themselves in trouble. So the early tuition might be actually worth the money. I think you even used the word tuition in our conversation just now.
Correct. So basically, I've talked about this in my book as well, that ideally, you want to make your mistakes early when you're financial capital is low, but your human capital is very high. When you've got a long number of years of earnings ahead, it is fine to make the mistakes small and fast and get them out of the way very quickly. Because if you win big in the very early stages of your investing journey, then you'll end up taking all the wrong lessons from favorable outcomes. The maturity to separate process from outcomes comes after many years in the market. Many newcomer investors came into the market in 2020 and 2021 during the roaring bull market. And the moment the Federal Reserve started raising interest rates, most of these meme stocks and profitless tech companies have collapsed 70-80%. And that is when you incur permanent loss of capital. So that is why you want to have the maturity to separate process from outcomes. As an investor, you have only two things in your control: your personal research process and your personal behavior. There's nothing else in your control. This humility, this acknowledgement of the role of luck and randomness in the market, all this comes only with experience. It takes many years to get this wisdom.
Now, that's very true. In your book, you repeatedly talk about two sides of a pursuit here. One is the reading part, which you talked about, and the second half of it is writing, that you actually write things down, you journal things. Right. Can you talk about the importance of both? I can't picture a successful investor who is not reading all the time. And at the same time, it's a superpower to be actually able to sit down and write things down and keep a record of your thoughts and the process and why you're buying or selling. I think it's very helpful. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So let me talk about the reading aspect first. That's very, very important. Reading and learning are both interconnected. Charlie Munger has said that the game of life is the game of everlasting learning. And he has also said that those who keep learning will keep rising in life. These to me were profound words, and I embrace them as a way of life. You see, the body is limited in ways that the mind is not. In fact, by the time most people are 40 years old, their bodies begin to deteriorate. But there is no limit to the amount of growth and development that the mind can sustain. Reading keeps our mind alive and growing, and that is why we should all inculcate a healthy reading habit. Books are truly life-changing once you have developed the habit of reading every day while watching your every thought. The neural connections that compound through the effort will make you an entirely new person after a few years. Buffett and Munger estimate that they spend 80% of their day reading or thinking about what they have read. Therein lies the secret to becoming smarter. The way to achieve success in life is to learn constantly. Once, when asked about the key to his success, Buffett held up stacks of paper and said, "Read 500 pages like this every day." That's how knowledge works. It builds up like compound interest. And compound interest, like Albert Einstein has said, is the most powerful force in the universe. So what happens when you apply such an incredible power to knowledge building? You become a learning machine. Even after achieving such enormous success, Buffett still reads for many hours every day. And he often credits this good habit of his for much of his success in life. Reading allows him to learn the lessons of others. The more you read, the more you will build your mental repertoire. And incrementally, the knowledge you add to your stockpile will grow over time as it combines with everything new you put in there. This is compounding in action, and it works with knowledge in much the same way as it does with interest. Eventually, when faced with new, challenging, or ambiguous situations, you will be able to draw on this dynamic inner repository, or what Munger refers to as a lattice work of mental models. Now, what are mental models? Mental models are an explanation of how things work, what variables matter in a given situation, and how they interact with one another. In short, mental models are how we make sense of the world. So this is a brief about the importance of reading. Now, let me talk about the writing part. That's also very, very important. So Like I mentioned in my book, I've maintained a personal journal since late 2014, and I consider it to be one of the best value investments I've ever made. Since that day, I've been keeping track of my investing decisions and subsequent developments in the journal. And this has helped me a lot in learning about myself and improving as both an investor and as an individual. I receive a lot of valuable feedback and use it to correct my biases. The process of structuring our thoughts into a journal entry helps bring clarity to our thinking. A periodic review is an important part of the process, and this is where you start getting better. Realizing where you make mistakes, why you make them, what are the common mistakes that you tend to make and why, will help you improve over time. Whenever the outcome of a past decision is known, revisit your decision journal, and the odds are you will discover some surprises. It won't be uncommon to find that in many of the favorable outcomes, the original reasoning wasn't always right. Outcomes distort our thinking a lot, and unless we are intellectually honest, we will end up taking the wrong lessons from favorable outcomes. Because it is not intuitively natural to fact-check how the events unfolded, especially after a favorable result. And we may be right a lot of the time, but it may well be for the wrong reasons. And this self-realization can be very humbling. It is also how we learn and improve. As you can see, writing is actually a thinking exercise, and it is a medium for increased self-awareness and understanding.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. I think that's the only way to grow and improve is just keeping a record. I like to keep a record of every single stock I ever invested in and every single stock I considered. And I have notes, and then I like to see how they perform since. And I'm trying to learn from it, and especially from the places where things could have led to some trouble. And identify the sources of trouble. I think it's really eye-opening. Now, I have a question about the upside itself. So you do all the research, you find the right investment, everything makes sense. But aren't you surprised sometimes that something you thought could be a double or a triple goes up 10 times? So in a sense, it's very hard to truly appreciate the upside. And my learning has been just waiting and staying with an idea long enough really pays off in the long run. I'm curious about your thoughts about it.
So very good question. Let me elaborate this very nicely. So multi-baggers don't happen by planning. They happen by chance. What do I mean by that? In today's dynamic world, it is very difficult or almost impossible to take a 10-year view on a stock or a business. The maximum we can do is form a reasonable estimate of whether the business will do well for the next 2 to 3 years and then keep evaluating along the way. So you buy a stock, like I do, for example. When I buy a stock, I purchase it with a mindset of 2 to 3 years. And if the fundamentals and the future prospects remain intact and good, and the valuations remain sensible and make sense to me, I hold on. This is how multi-baggers has happened for investors in reality. This is actually how it basically works. And how, you know, like you mentioned, like, you know, we buy a stock thinking it'll just double, but sometimes it, you know, goes up 5x, 8x, 10, or even 10x. How and when does those things happen? This can only happen when there is a change in perception among investors regarding the business of the stock. And how does this happen? If you invest in businesses in secular growth industries with good capable managements, those managements have the capability to pivot into adjacent areas and, you know, create extra value for shareholders. This is how you get those big multi-baggers. You know, just see how, you know, in Facebook, how Mark Zuckerberg pivoted from desktop to mobile, how Microsoft pivoted from office products to the cloud, Azure. So, you know, when you find great managements in good, solid business industries, they tend to surprise on the upside. And that is why, you know, there is always a potential for positive surprises when you're partnering with very smart, capable managements. Be a very reluctant seller in such kind of businesses, because those managements often tend to, and, you know, who have got the growth DNA. Very, very important point. The management has to have a hunger for growth and for value creation. Once you have found that kind of a management, don't let go. Just stay put. Even if the stock becomes very expensive for the short run, it will undergo some time correction, no problem. The other stocks in the portfolio will do the job that time. But don't let go of such great management very easily. I mean, look at Berkshire Hathaway, for example. You know, there have been multiple five-year periods in history when the stock of Berkshire Hathaway has given zero returns, basically. The stock of Adobe Systems gave zero returns between year 2000 and 2013. 13 long years when the earnings kept on growing, but the stock basically went nowhere because it had entered a bubble territory in year 2000. So you have to differentiate between bubble valuations and expensive valuations. Now, this is again a fine art. This is not an exact science. This you'll get to know only with the passage of time and experience. When to sell because of bubble valuations and when to hold on in spite of expensive valuations. So this is a, you know, this is a clear distinction which has to be made.
No, I like that. In your book, you write about the inner scorecard. So investment profession is very competitive. And people always wonder who your peers are. There are all kinds of labels, value, growth, momentum. And obviously the industry, especially the media, tries to compare and contrast and say which asset or which style is performing better or worse. And I think with the abundance of ways to share, you mentioned Twitter, but all the platforms, it's becoming even harder today than ever before to keep an inner scorecard. Tell me more about what an inner scorecard means to you. And I know, you know, Buffett talks about it a lot. And how do you keep it truly inner, in the sense that you are not influenced by the outside noise? I'm curious about that.
So the inner scorecard is the inner set of criteria and standards by which a person judges herself or himself. In contrast, the outer scorecard is an external comparative picture of self-worth predicated on the judgment of others. An outer scorecard, which many people have, asks, what will people think of me? Will they judge me by the way I dress or the way I look or the car I drive? But the inner scorecard, which is much more important, asks, am I doing the right things? Am I treating people correctly? Is this working for me as an individual? If in your heart you know who you really are and that the choice you made was absolutely right, then the criticism of others should be considered and analyzed to see whether it truly has any merit. But it should not be given permission to belittle what you're trying to achieve. Let your life be guided by internal principles, not external validation. Self-respect beats social approval every time. We are not perfect, nor should we pretend to be. But we should always endeavor to be the best version of ourselves. And this is my constant pursuit every day, just to try to be the best version of myself and to carry out my daily rituals and duties with full honor and integrity.
What about the investment side? How do you know you're on the right track?
Very simple. So basically, in my book, I've talked about like the example of how Buffett acted as per the inner scorecard during the dot-com bubble. A lot of his value investing peers and colleagues basically caved in to the peer pressure and trying to catch up with their peers in terms of short-run performance. And they dumped all the value stocks and bought into these egregiously valued technology stocks. And eventually they paid the price over the next 2 years and they had to shut down their investment firms. But Buffett, he was so clear, he was so true to his inner scorecard that I'm not going to venture away from the core principles of value investing. I'm not going to, you know, pay a very astronomical high price for an unprofitable business, because at the end of the day, investing in a stock is simply like purchasing a part of a business. When you buy a business in a private transaction, you always, you know, look, you do all your thorough due diligence and then you try to pay a sensible price. The same mindset has to be there when we invest in a stock in the stock market. So, you know, the outer scorecard can be something like Mr. Market, which is basically, you know, very, very erratic and volatile. But the inner scorecard is basically the intrinsic value of a stock, which converges to the market price eventually converges with the intrinsic value, but only over the long run. It may not happen in the span of 3 to 6 months or a year, but over 2 to 3 years and more, eventually stock prices catch up with earnings and true intrinsic value.
That makes sense. I'm thinking about value investing as a philosophy, and that's the principles that you talk about in the book and people that consider themselves value investors follow. I'm curious, what do you think? Are these principles that worked the last 100 years or worked for a period of time? What makes you think that they work in the future? I know it's a provocative question, but I'm curious what makes you think, and I personally believe that those principles are here to stay. But with the world changing so much, why do you think value investing is a philosophy that's here to stay?
Principle of buying something for less than what it is worth will never get old. And Phil Fisher had rightly said that the stock market is filled with individuals who know the price of everything, but the value of nothing. Now, stock price is known to everyone in the market, but value is understood by only a select few. Stock prices randomly fluctuate every day, sometimes wildly on either side, but the underlying business value changes very slowly. And therein lies the big opportunity for us as value investors. Focusing on what is moving is part of our evolutionary instincts. And this explains why market participants focus more on the volatile stock prices, which keep bobbing up and down every day, than on business values, which change quite slowly. And capitalizing on others' desire to avoid downside volatility is what makes value investing work. As Joel Greenblatt aptly put it, value investing works, but value investing does not work all the time. And that is why value investing works.
I like what I'm hearing. I'm curious to investigate a little bit the concept of the philosophy working. What does it mean to you that it's working or not working? How do you know? How can you tell?
So this is something which we learn only from experience, that the market cycle, which commentators often talk about, the market cycle means nothing but the liquidity cycle. Okay. And when there is a gush of liquidity in the global stock markets or in any particular stock market, then the discount rate or the interest rates basically fall. And all these businesses which have got their earnings far out into the future, they tend to start getting chased by investors, because investors start ascribing high valuation to those distant cash flows. So basically, of the present, let's just go back to first principles of investing. The intrinsic value of a stock is the present value of the future cash flows, discounted for the uncertainty of receiving those cash flows, right? So during a period of low interest rates or zero interest rates, you know, those distant cash flows way out into the future start getting discounted at a lower rate, and that's why they become valuable. And that is why during those phases, investors focus on growth stocks, even though they are not profitable, because they start ascribing value 10, 20 years out. But the moment interest rates go up, then investors' focus shifts to present earnings, current year earnings. And that is where the value stocks or deep value stocks with underlying assets, underlying earnings, you know, immediate visibility of cash flows and profits, they tend to start getting bid up. This is basically how deep value investing versus growth investing works in different phases of the market cycle or the liquidity cycle.
That makes sense. So the companies will change, everything can change, but the philosophy behind it, which is buying things for less than they're worth, should work in the sense that it will allow us to get respectable returns also in the future. That's what I'm hearing.
Correct.
I'm curious to explore the concept of edge in investing. And you write about the informational edge and behavioral edge that investors can have. And obviously, we all want to succeed. We all want to find ways to find the right ideas, buy them at the right time. And if you go back and you read Buffett and you talk about it in the book, people would actually physically travel to pick up the annual report. They would take the train. Buffett traveled to see some companies in person, and you couldn't get the report unless you mailed the company or walked over and got the annual report. Nowadays, everybody can sit down, fire up their laptop, and can get an incredible access to information. So the informational edge went away. And the behavior, or the way we control our behavior, is the only edge we have left, it seems. Can you talk more about it? It's a very intriguing topic, and I, of course, agree with you, but I want to hear more about it.
So traditionally, there have been three sources of edge for the individual investor. The first one, which you rightly mentioned, was the information edge, or basically being able to invest in a superior manner just by having access to more information. But with the advent of the internet, the information edge is basically gone now, because everyone has got access to the same information from the public sources. The second source of edge traditionally for investors has been the analytical edge. But with more and more smart people entering the investing profession, even the analytical edge is fast getting compressed. But the one edge, which is the most durable and sustainable in my view, is that of behavior and temperament. 50 years ago, the best investors were the ones with an informational edge. But today, the best investors are the ones with a behavioral edge. As the speed of information dissemination in the markets and competition for short-term outperformance among money managers increased over the years, time horizons and patience levels significantly decreased. And today, an investor's edge is less about knowing more than others about a specific stock and more about the mindset, discipline, and willingness to take a long-term view about the intrinsic value of a business. This is what the behavioral edge is all about.
You know, I often say that I don't think I'm smarter than anybody else or faster than anybody else, or at least than most investors, but I think I'm more patient than an average person or an investor. And it makes me think of what I like to call a time arbitrage. So it kind of bridges the concept that you're touching on. And maybe you also use a similar vocabulary to describe it, which to me means we're both looking at the same stock and you have one investor that's interested in how this company will do in the next 3 months and until the next earnings release. And I sit down and I look and I'm curious how this company will do as a business in the next 3 to 5 years. So the last arbitrage that I see is the time arbitrage. I have the luxury of waiting those 3-5 years or sometimes longer for the story to come to life. And most investors seem to not have that luxury or just choose not to have that kind of investment horizon. And that's where my patience really pays off. Do you have some thoughts on that?
Yes, you're absolutely right. I think time arbitrage is very, very powerful. Just by having a longer time horizon than others, we can significantly outperform the majority of the investors, because most investors, you know, basically are fixated on the latest quarter's earnings per share. What has been the EPS which has been printed, right? They actually, you know, nail it down right to the last decimal point. I mean, that is how, you know, that is the world we are living in today, that people, you know, punish a stock even if, you know, if the earnings per share is just 4-5 cents lower than estimates of the analyst, the stock price falls by 10-15%. Just imagine how short-sighted the world has become. So the solution to this problem is to embrace delayed gratification and to resist instant gratification. Just to have a long-term mindset and avoid all the variety of distractions which are prevalent in the world today.
You know, it immediately makes me think that the more short-term focused everybody else is, the more we stand out with our multi-year investment horizon.
Yeah, let me add something very important here. So more than 70% of a stock's intrinsic value lies in the terminal value. And the terminal value is 5-10 years out into the future, right? And the present year earnings, you know, are barely less than 5% of a stock's total intrinsic value. So if the present year earnings disappoint and the stock is down 20-25%, but that present year earnings was constituting just 5% of the overall intrinsic value, while the stock is down 20% and more, therein lies an opportunity. The stock market is basically, this is what, you know, makes the stock market so attractive for patient people like us, that we can exploit the short-term mindset of all the other participants. And just by taking a longer-term view of a business, we can come out ahead in the long run.
I like that. You've been reading about the market and doing an enormous amount of research, as you mentioned, over those years. I'm curious how you have evolved as an investor from the early ideas you discovered to where you are today. What has changed? What has remained the same? Your investing mindset, your philosophy. Can you share a little bit more?
Yes.
Your own journey?
Yes. So my personal investment opportunity set has significantly expanded over the years with time and experience in the markets. Initially, it was restricted only to low price to earning and low price to book stocks, because like most investors, I started off by reading Benjamin Graham's The Intelligent Investor. Then I read about Buffett, Phil Fisher and Charlie Munger. And then I started investing in quality businesses at reasonable valuations. But today, it covers multiple areas of the investment universe, including cyclicals, spin-offs, merger arbitrage, promoter management change, and various other methods of investing. So instead of being restricted by my personal biased views to a small opportunity set, as was the case during my early years, I am now able to invest in a variety of industries and situations wherever I find mispricing of value and a highly favorable risk and return trade-off. You see, no single strategy works all of the time and in every kind of market. And that is why it is essential to build up one's investing arsenal to be able to hunt for value from within different areas. And over the years, I've come to realize and appreciate just why this is so critically important. It is because a bull market is always going on at all points of time in some specific sectors of the stock market. For instance, if I talk about the Indian stock market, during the 2009 to 2013 bear market in India, consumer discretionary, pharmaceutical and information technology stocks created a lot of wealth for investors. And new trends, new sector leaders always emerge during the depths of a bear market. So always keep your eyes and ears and minds open when there is chaos all around, because that is when the market will guide you in the right direction and tell you where the new leaders are emerging. That is the time to actually increase and step up your research when all your despondent peers are basically giving up on investing in research. That is where you gain a big, big edge over your competition in the market.
The never-ending fear and greed dance that happens. We value investors get excited when stocks are falling, and it's very confusing to the outside world. I'm curious, how do you think value investing is misunderstood by people? And I think what you mentioned, how early on you were buying just cheap, low multiple stocks, some people think that value investing is just that, but then you and we all apply the same mindset of paying less than something is worth to pretty much anything. And I joke about it, but it starts with grocery shopping and goes all the way to buying a house and somewhere in between to buying investments. Can you talk about how value investing can be misunderstood by people? Why it gets misunderstood sometimes?
Yes. So value investing is not about buying bad or damaged businesses cheap, because no price is cheap for a business in decline, right? So, you know, that those businesses are nothing but a value trap. Value traps are those businesses which look cheap optically on trailing earnings, but they are actually very expensive in reality because the underlying business, the core business, is in disarray. So as a good example here, the print newspaper stocks in India are trading very cheap at very low P multiples. But they are a value trap because now we consume news through digital means, through digital media, not through print media. It's getting less and less relevant over time. So value investing is about getting something, you know, getting maximum value for the price that you're paying for the lowest amount of risk and reaching your personal goals, achieving your personal goals in the appropriate amount of time. That is all that value investing is all about, actually. It's about, you know, our personal goals, our risk tolerance, our risk appetite, our circle of competence. It's very, very personal. So that's why, you know, like, you know, on our same stock, you know, 10 different value investors may have 10 different views because everyone's situation and mindset is different. So value investing is very interlinked to personal finance as well and personal temperament of the person. And it's not about buying bad or damaged businesses cheap. You know, that strategy may work for a short period of time, but eventually it will get you into trouble because in those businesses, time works against you. Unlike a good business where time is your friend.
And you're also closing your mind to all the other opportunities that you mentioned that could be hiding somewhere else outside of the low multiple world. Mm-hmm. You write about simplicity in life and investing, and it's such a big topic, but can you talk more about it? Why simplicity matters? Usually people get drawn to things that are complicated, hard to explain. It makes you look smart. And Buffett and Munger and also your book talks about keeping things simple. Tell me more about it. I really like it.
So simplicity is the ultimate sophistication. And simplicity is the end result of long, hard work, not the starting point. The ability to reduce something to its essence is the true mark of understanding. Simplicity is a very powerful construct. And Albert Einstein, the famous legend Einstein, recognized the power of simplicity, and it was the key to his breakthrough in physics. Einstein noted that the 5 ascending levels of intellect were smart, intelligent, brilliant, genius, simple. For Einstein, simplicity was simply the highest level of intellect. And in the field of investing, simplicity is the way to long-term success. Unlike the figure skaters at the Olympics, we don't get any extra points for higher degrees of difficulty in investing. Originality or complexity are neither necessary nor sufficient conditions for generating superior long-term returns. As investors, our job is simply to compound capital over time at the highest possible rate with the minimum amount of risk. And we achieve this objective by seeking out undervalued stocks of companies within our circle of competence. Investing is not about being original or creative. It is about looking for the greatest amount of value for the price paid with the least amount of risk. And putting in more time and effort does not guarantee better results in investing. Rather, doing less and making fewer but better choices is more beneficial. Look for simple businesses that require fewer assumptions and fewer hypothetical scenarios to work out, and that do not require discounting cash flows from way out into the future to justify the investment. In the chapter on simplicity in my book, I have also discussed the concept of minimalism. Minimalism is basically an extension of simplicity. Not only do you take things from complex to simple, but also you try to get rid of anything that is unnecessary. Because very few things really matter in life. And because very few things matter, we must think carefully about what really matters rather than chasing the new thing, which will probably not really matter. And applying this principle to the field of investing, it is important to identify and focus on the few key variables that really matter to an investment decision. This vastly simplifies the process and improves the probability of a successful outcome. It helps us separate the long-term signal from the short-term noise and to calmly think through any investing decision. Yes, reading the annual reports, filings, press releases, and footnotes to the accounts is important. And occasionally, we will be able to dig out some extra detail that might give us an analytical advantage. But in my view, understanding the big picture, which is the 2 or 3 key variables that really matter, is equally, if not more, important. Some of us may be average at business valuation, but still can achieve above average results by being able to better place the available information in the appropriate context, by remembering the big picture, and by being able to pinpoint the few factors that really matter to an investment, because different metrics and ratios are salient for different types of companies and investment situations. And in one of his past lectures at Columbia University, Joel Greenblatt taught his students the importance of always keeping the big picture in mind. He said, investing success has got nothing to do with the ability to do a detailed spreadsheet. It has more to do with the big picture. So focus on the big picture. Think of the logic, not just the formula. In investing and in many areas of life, less is more. So simplify, simplify, simplify.
I like to call it the easy pile. And early on in my career, I sat on a lot of meetings where somebody would try to explain some investment case over 3 hours, and we would leave the meeting more confused than we started. And I would think, isn't it the goal to try to explain an idea in a few simple sentences? Then you can go into details and explain the pricing, the distribution, all those things. But the actual essence, as you mentioned, we should be able to explain it in half a page, in under a minute, and then you can tell me more. But I think it's something that comes with experience, and it's a real skill. And I think down the road, it actually makes the investment easier and more successful, because you will more likely hold on to an idea that's so easy to check on, so easy to explain, than a very complex idea. The conviction is just harder to keep in my mind if it's a very complicated idea. But that's been my experience. And, you know, all respect to anybody that wants to go after the hard pile, as Buffett calls it, but I'm very happy in the easier pile. It sounds like you are too.
The problem in the field of finance is that, you know, because there are so many highly educated people from prestigious institutions, they just can't accept that something can be, you know, the obvious ideas can be so simple. So to get that intellectual kick, to, you know, feel intellectually accomplished, they venture into the difficult areas and difficult investment situations. But the way, you know, Buffett and Munger have taught us to avoid difficult problems in life and in investing is to avoid them altogether. That is basically what I do. I just avoid. There are more than 5,000 listed stocks in the Indian stock market, and all that I need to create wealth for myself and my investors is to choose 20-25 good businesses and then just stay put with them through all the ups and downs patiently, and let the managements, you know, they know how to do the job. Let them do their job. Let them do all the heavy lifting while I let value compound over time. That is, I think, the most peaceful and fulfilling way to do investing.
I like the sound of that. We manage multi-generational wealth. So we manage family fortunes that already lasted a few generations. And we also work with clients that created wealth in their lifetime. And then they hope that their fortunes will also last multiple generations, or at least outlast their life. In your book, you have this very interesting quote that I highlighted to you. It comes from Bhagavad Gita about material wealth. In one of the teachings, and you'll probably explain it a lot better than I'm trying to explain it, but the idea is that the material wealth, we're just trustees of it. We don't actually own it. And it gives us a certain humility and a sense of detachment to think of material wealth as something we're looking after, which makes me think of family fortunes and the work we do. Can you talk more about it? I found it really eye-opening and interesting. As something you take care of, you are a steward of the capital.
Correct. So, you know, I've talked about the concept of good karma and philanthropy in my book. And the reason for that is we are able to create wealth only with the help of others. So giving back also needs to be a part of our planning. And you can derive a great deal of happiness and personal fulfillment from the act of making a positive difference in other people's lives. Givers greatly enjoy seeing the wealth they have created during their working lives come to life again by enabling good things to happen during their lifetimes for targeted causes that carry significant meaning to them. As the saying goes, you can't take it with you. And givers derive great happiness from converting their financial resources into actions and values they truly care about. Now, one of my role models in the field of philanthropy was John D. Rockefeller. Rockefeller's charitable giving began with his first job at the age of 16 as a clerk, when he gave 6% of his earnings to charity. And by the time he was 20, his charity exceeded 10% of his income. As Rockefeller's wealth grew, so did his giving. And we can all learn a big lesson from Rockefeller's life that it is never too early to start giving and helping others. To make a difference in someone's life, you don't need to be brilliant, rich or perfect. You just need to care. And it doesn't matter where you are or if you have a little to give or a lot to give. Something happens to your heart when you share with others. Something that changes you for the better. And over time, as my wealth has increased, so have my charitable contributions, and it gives me a great happiness to put a smile on the face of those who are less privileged. I know one more interconnected thing here, like, you know, you talked about the importance of stewardship of capital. So again, you know, basically by making a positive difference to the lives of our clients, you know, all, at the end of the day, those clients are people, right? They are basically families. And if we simply treat their money as we would treat our own money, that is where true alignment of interest takes place. And we end up doing a good job for basically building as well as preserving multi-generational wealth. So I think, you know, the mindset has to be that of a fiduciary when you are when you're acting as a steward of public capital. And it's a job of very high responsibility. I think, you know, both of us can really appreciate this fact because we are in the similar profession. So having this mindset is very, very important. You know, I often tell people, when there is so much money in the middle of the playing field, why do you want to go near the edges just to capture that extra little bit of return through, you know, scrupulous means? You don't need to do that. Just be directionally correct and then let the magic of time do the rest for you. That's, you know, how compounding works.
You touched on something really interesting, and it comes up in my writing as well, how at school, they taught me certain models and a very scientific approach to managing money. But I don't remember anybody telling me that there are people behind the portfolios. There's an actual human being behind the portfolio. And that human being might not be comfortable holding certain investments. That human being has to go to sleep at night. And I always say that to me, the ultimate check or ultimate test is the quality of sleep, my own as somebody managing other people's money, but also the quality of sleep of the client. And even if some model or scientific research tells me to build a portfolio in a certain way, but I know that I won't be able to sleep well and my client will not be able to sleep either, that's where the conversation stops and we have to rethink where we're going. And I think that's where something gets lost in how scientifically we can think about the money in a very abstract way, all the efficiencies. But what it comes down to is, can you go to bed and sleep well with the investments that you're holding? And will your clients be able to sleep well? I think to me, it's the ultimate test here.
Absolutely. I fully agree with you. There's no point in becoming rich if you have a terrifying journey along the way. It's meaningless. Stress-adjusted returns matter much more than absolute returns over the long run.
Very much so. You talk about the importance of checklists, and I find it really interesting, and it's a topic that came up in a lot of books and writings in the last few years, more so than in the past from what I remember. But can you talk about the importance of checklists? How do you use checklists, how they help you, and why they're so important in the investment process?
So a prudent investor never purchases ownership in a company without conducting the necessary due diligence. So learn about the company and its competitors, both listed and unlisted, from company websites, filings, and information on the internet. Read the last 10 years of annual reports, proxies, notes and schedules to the financial statements, and management discussion and analysis section in the annual reports. Within that section, check for changes in the management tone and industry outlook, and observe the recent trends in insider shareholding. And after you have concluded the initial groundwork, study the following parameters in a checklist fashion: income statement analysis, cash flow analysis, return ratios analysis, operating efficiency analysis, balance sheet analysis, management analysis, as well as a psychological checklist of the standard causes of human misjudgment. All the 7 checklists are described in detail in my book as well. By being very methodical and systematic in your research process, you basically avoid blind spots. You know, you don't basically miss out on any important parameters. Now, obviously, some unknown may happen in the future. So that risk is always there in investing and in life in general. But at least by being thorough in your research process, by making use of a checklist, you enhance your probability of finding a winning stock. Now, it is important to note that the ideal checklist is subjective and it varies from situation to situation. An investor should have a clear understanding of what he is trying to achieve. For instance, the primary checklist items when investing in spin-offs or commodities or cyclicals is very different from the primary checklist items when you're investing in high-quality secular growth stocks, where quality of business and quality of management is the most important.
That makes sense. I like the way you think about it. Structures your process. At least it helps me to structure a process. And there are certain things that on my checklist apply to just certain ideas, but being able to go through a list. And to me, the big part is not just the things I'm looking for in the sense that they will make money for me, but also the things that I want to see potentially that could get me in trouble. And being able to eliminate a lot of ideas or at least pay more attention to certain things because they were already on the list. And I like the idea that a checklist is a very personal thing. I know investors that have checklists with 10 points, 10 questions, and I know investors that have hundreds of questions in their checklist. So I think everybody has to find the right checklist that works with their personality. I like the concept that you mentioned, and it comes up in a lot of investment conversations, and it's delayed gratification. And funny enough, the other day I had a conversation with somebody on this podcast that has no investment background, and we ended up talking about delayed gratification. Tell me your thoughts. Is it a gene that gives us delayed gratification, or is it something that we can learn? What are your thoughts?
Charlie Munger said that if you're not born with the deferred gratification gene, then it is very difficult to overcome that. But this problem has a simple solution. It is simple, but not easy. It requires a tremendous amount of patience, consistency, dedication, and a deep conviction in the power of compounding. One small step can change your life. The Kaizen Way by Robert Maurer is one of my all-time favorite books, and it talks about the power of compounding small daily positive actions. And this small book talks about the big idea of Kaizen, which is Japanese for taking small steps for continual improvement. The difference between those who fail and those who succeed is the courage to act repeatedly. And most people, when faced with change, will feel at least some element of fear. Very often that fear can get in the way of actually making the change. The idea of Kaizen is to make such small changes in your life that your brain doesn't even realize that you're trying to change and therefore doesn't get in the way. Kaizen is a neat mental hack that helps us bypass our brain's fear response. Usually, if we try to tackle a big life change all at once, like completely cutting out sugar from our diet or learning to invest in the stock market or inculcating a reading habit, it might work for a few days, but we will give up soon. This is because the big changes trigger the brain's subconscious fears, which ends up hindering us. So taking small incremental steps is the way to get past that and succeed. For instance, when it comes to investing in the stock market, we overwhelm ourselves with big questions like, how can I pick the best stock for my portfolio? Instead, use Kaizen and focus on small questions like, what little step could I take today toward learning how to pick stocks effectively? If you want to form the habit of reading one annual report a day, start with reading one page of an annual report a day, then increase it to 2 pages, then 3, and so on. You see, big bold actions like lofty New Year resolutions often get us the initial results, but they don't take into account things like fear or mental resistance. The smaller steps, however, get us to the desired goal because they can be incorporated more easily into our daily life, and small steps make delaying gratification easier and sustainable. So whether it is quitting a bad habit or forming a good one, the idea is to start small, very small, and then to build on it over time. As the saying goes, if we are facing in the right direction, all we have to do is keep on walking.
I love that. And never stop. Is that right? Never stop.
That's it. Yep.
That's it. I like that. Tell me again, what's the name of the book?
The name of the book is One Small Step Can Change Your Life, The Kaizen Way.
I will include it in the notes. I think a lot of people will enjoy that book and learn from it. It really resonates with me. I haven't read this particular book, but I read other books that talk about making those small changes and creating tiny habits. And there's a whole school of thought around it, how we can make a difference in our life and also improve investments, just making one small step, one small change at a time. You share your thoughts about luck, chance, serendipity, and randomness. And I found it really interesting because people come to the world of investing, they get really good at it, and then they look back. And I think it's a very humbling experience to realize and accept that some of it is, as you mentioned, your own effort, your research, how you control your behavior. But then there's an element of, and you can call it all those four things that I just mentioned, from luck to randomness. But it's refreshing to accept that some of it we don't have control over. Can you talk more about it?
So very, very important topic. And you know, I would like to say here that improving luck requires the humility to acknowledge its presence. So unless you acknowledge the presence of luck, you won't be able to improve your luck in the first place. And successful investors appreciate the role of luck. They are intellectually honest and conscious of alternative histories. That is, the silent events in their lives. These are the events that could have happened but didn't happen. Warren Buffett credits a large part of his success to his winning the Ovarian lottery by being born in America, where his skill of capital allocation earned him billions of dollars. Similarly, I consider myself lucky to have been born and brought up in India, a vibrant democracy with a rich, diverse culture and a plethora of high-growth investment opportunities in its stock market, where trillions of dollars of wealth is expected to be created in the future. Now, here I would also like to add that all of us have the opportunity to be lucky, because beyond having the basics of health and sustenance, luck simply comes down to a series of choices. If you live in a free society, you are very lucky. Luck surrounds you every day. You're constantly having lucky things happen to you, whether or not you recognize it. And lucky people are those who acknowledge just how fortunate they are and feel grateful for what they have. If you want to feel rich, just count all the gifts you have that money can't buy. In my view, this self-realization is the most important step towards being lucky. You may not be doing well at your job or with your investments, but if you have a loving family and good health, it's worth being grateful for already having some of the most precious things in life. Now, you can increase your surface area for good fortune and being on the right side of luck, chance, serendipity, and randomness by taking appropriate action. Many people think that successful people are simply born lucky. But the reality is that some people get luckier than others by arranging their lives in certain characteristic patterns. They tend to position themselves in the path of onrushing luck. They tend to go where events are moving fastest and where they can find their lucky break. They try their hand at multiple ventures with low risk and high payoff characteristics. They surround themselves with smarter and wiser people. When pursuing their goals, they always leave some room for serendipity. They do not ignore the importance of accidental discoveries like events, parties, meetings, conferences, and chance happenings. And they keep an open mind to all possibilities. They take calculated risks. They stick with their initial convictions, but not when all hope is lost. They believe in the dictum, strong beliefs loosely held. In short, they move with life, not against it. And as a result, lucky people are able to take advantage of life's good breaks while minimizing the effects of bad ones.
Have you always felt this way about luck, or was there any experience in your life that made you appreciate the element of luck and serendipity more than before?
There have been so many experiences. Like I talked in my book as well, that I've survived 3 separate big accidents in my life. And just by virtue of being alive, every day I just feel so grateful every day when I wake up that, you know, I just feel so fortunate and lucky. So this feeling of gratitude just keeps me in a state of contentment and happiness every day. I think looking back at what could have happened but didn't happen, just not taking things for granted, this attitude has helped me greatly in life.
It invites luck. I like what you said, that acknowledging that luck plays a role invites more luck to your life. I think it's a wonderful way to put it. You talk about psychological biases that investors can have, and there are many, but can you pick one or two and talk about it and maybe share your own experience, how you were able to overcome a certain bias that you had and that allowed you to make a better quality decision investing?
Yes. So in my book, I've written about my investment in a stock in India during 2017, in which I had made a very high return of more than 270% in less than just 5 months on a very big allocation. And 1 month after the date of my sale, I came across a news report in the media which mentioned that HEG's main product, graphite electrodes, were being sold in the Indian market at an even higher price per metric ton, and that the supply situation in the market was becoming even more tighter. When the facts change your mind. So I immediately repurchased HEG stock, this time with half the percentage allocation that I had at the time of my previous exit. And in one single go, I was able to conquer a host of personal biases that had affected me since the beginning of my investing career, including anchoring bias, commitment and consistency bias, and status quo bias. And this is why the HEG investment will always be very special to me. It was a significant step forward in my evolution towards rationality. I finally exited my second investment in HEG at a profit in August 2018, resulting in a compounded total profit of more than 350% on my initial invested capital in this company stock. And this great outcome was possible only because I was able to respond to change. The key to surviving and thriving in the markets long term is being adaptive to change.
That's very true. Being aware of those biases really helps. And you can notice when you're making a certain decision because of a certain bias. And I think it can improve your quality of decision making. But it takes a lot of self-awareness. And you clearly had it, you know, ready to act on. And at the time, it helped you a lot. It's a really eye-opening experience for an investor because we start to forget and not see certain things. And I'm glad you write about it and talk about it and you're able to implement it in your everyday investment process. You touched on it a little bit in terms of, you know, cheap stocks versus quality stocks, but you write how high quality always beats bargains. Can you talk more about your preference for great businesses? And you mentioned how it was an evolution and you got there, but it looks like nowadays you're mostly interested in great businesses.
That's true. And it is because quality increases the margin of safety over time. The margin of safety can be derived from the gap between price and value. And it can also be derived from the quality of the business. For example, a business that can grow intrinsic value at a rate of 18% annually is worth much more than a business that is growing its value at 6% annually, all other things being equal. Because the higher quality compounder is worth a lot more over a long-term holding period than the lower quality business, the former offers a larger margin of safety. The problem with investing only in statistically cheap securities, also known as cigar butts, is that the underlying business's economic value gradually erodes with each passing day, making the investment a race against time. As investors, our goal should be to minimize the number of decisions and to reduce the potential for unforced errors. It is much more productive to be invested in businesses with growing intrinsic value over time because it allows for a larger margin of error in case we are wrong and higher returns in case we are right. Without doubt, cigar butts as a category have the potential to outperform quality over a short holding period, but over the long term, companies with increasing intrinsic value over time are the clear winners. On balance, paying a high price for even a great business may not always work out well if you have to sell that business in 1 or 2 years. But if you plan to hold your stocks for longer periods of time, say 5 years, 10 years or longer, then quality becomes much more important than cheap initial valuations when assessing margin of safety. And this leads to a very important conclusion. When investing in shorter term opportunities like cyclicals and special situations, pay greater attention to price and mean reversion. But when investing in long term compounders, pay maximum attention to the quality of business and management above all else.
I agree. I'm curious, you mentioned Ben Graham. And Ben Graham was hugely influenced by the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. And only recently I came across this somebody's story about late years for Ben Graham, how he was less and less invested and he was waiting for the next Great Depression to follow. And there are recessions and crises since the Great Depression, but nothing really like the Great Depression. And I met throughout my career a lot of investors that were much older than me. Some of them already passed away. And they had memories of different markets, of low multiple markets, especially of the early 80s, when interest rates were in double digits, but also the multiples were in single digits, even for high quality companies. And they spend the last decades of their career waiting for the multiples to come down to the levels they saw in their youth. And it never happened again, not to that extent. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about the investor journey in terms of getting, I don't know if that's the right way to describe it, but really getting scared out of the market and waiting for a repeat of a period that might not ever happen again, the cigar butt period or the low multiple period. And you mentioned a little bit about the time you joined the market and what happened. And I'm curious, you know, extrapolating the next few decades as an investor and your journey, what can we do not to get scared out of the markets and not to fall in the trap of waiting for this incredible investment opportunity that might have happened early on in our career but may not happen ever again?
Very good question. And many times, investors who have experienced a bear market are unable to participate in the subsequent bull market due to price anchoring. Focus on value, not on necessarily getting the cheapest bottom price, which you saw in the previous bear market. Just sitting and waiting for the prices to crash is not value investing. In any market, you know, if you find a good, sensible risk-return trade-off, you should go for it with the understanding that if the price falls further, then you add more if you have more funds. And if you don't have more funds to deploy, then just patiently wait. That's all that you need to do. In my book, this is the reason why I've written a chapter titled Read More History and Fewer Forecasts. This is a very famous quote by Morgan Housel. And I've titled that chapter after his quote only. So The last sentence of the chapter is like this, that investors, I written about this a few years back in the book, that we should all be grateful and acknowledge that we've all been very lucky, from the year 2009 to 2021, basically for 12 long years, basically we were all the beneficiaries of low interest rates and abundant liquidity. So it was very easy to make, good amounts of money by literally buying anything during those 12 years. But now, like Howard Marks has said in his recent memo about the regime change, the big regime shift of moving into an era of high interest rates, you need to adapt to changing circumstances and invest accordingly. This is why I always say that, the key to surviving and thriving in the markets long term is to be adaptive to change. And the greatest investors are active seekers of truth. They accept reality as it is, not for what they wish for it to be or hope for it to be or want it to be. This is how you basically become objective and position your portfolio for success in the stock market by, just acknowledging which phase of the market cycle are we in, which interest rate cycle are we in. So we have to keep evolving in the times. The time for, buying all those profitless tech stocks over the last 12 years, many investors, many seasoned investors today, observe, they are still doubling down on their mistake by, averaging downwards in the same stocks which are falling. They're falling for a reason. A profitless tech company is valued very differently at 0% interest rate environment versus a 6% interest rate environment. The entire valuation changes completely, because if you plug the numbers into a discounted cash flow model in an Excel sheet, the discount, tiny changes in the discount rate magnify their impact on the intrinsic value of a stock. So this is basic investing and finance 101. But, because of price anchoring and recency bias, the investors just keep committing the same mistakes again and again. And that is why we have so few successful investors in the market over the long run.
It looks like you invested more time in this particular aspect than I have, at least recently. But let's explore it a bit. So a DCF, intrinsic value, in a lifetime of an investment, let's assume that you buy a company that you hold over 10 years. The interest rates in those 10 years, the same way as the interest rates during the pandemic in 3 years, were from 0 to 5 points or 4 points. Those rates will change and the environment will change dramatically. How do you think of the intrinsic value evolving in such a wide range, especially if you're in such a sensitive territory close to zero? How do you reconcile that and how that has influence on how you come up with the intrinsic value?
So I've talked about this in my book as well. I've mentioned there very clearly that the high growth stocks with very high growth expectations and assumptions way out into the future, those category of stocks, their intrinsic value is the most sensitive to tiny changes in interest rates. Whereas the value stocks or companies with current year earnings, which are basically, which have got immediate visibility of earnings, they are the least sensitive to changes in the interest rate. That's just how the discount rate with this DCF model basically works. It's like, cash flow of year one divided by 1 plus R, and then you have got cash flow of year two divided by 1 plus R to the power two. So basically, the more you discount cash flows from way out into the future, the more your present intrinsic value will be sensitive to changes in the discount rate. That is why the market is very intelligent, very smart. I know some people say that, this stock has fallen 80%, it's a bargain. No, the market is actually very, very, very smart. It's a collective wisdom of, hundreds of thousands of participants. And, they are all, trying to, achieve the same objective as me and you, trying to figure out the value of what something is worth and then trying to pay less for it. So let's respect the wisdom of the market and humbly acknowledge that, we just went wrong in our assessment. We were just not, adaptive, we just weren't able to adapt fast enough in a rapidly changing environment. We have to understand that the Federal Reserve in its history has never raised interest rates at such a fast pace in its history, like going from 0 to 4.5% within just within 6 months. That's the speed of change matters more to the market than the absolute rate of change. So if you look at history, there have been many periods when interest rates went up and stock prices also went up. They both can go up at the same time, as long as the increase in interest rates is gradual and orderly. But when interest rates go up sharply in a very short span of time, that is when equities get crushed very fast.
Very true. Do you think we will see the end of the Fed in our lifetime?
I don't really have a strong opinion on that. I think the Federal Reserve has just become too powerful and too deeply entrenched in the financial market system. So it's very difficult to entangle ourselves out, you know, away from the Fed. And that's why, you know, every, you know, majority of the time on news channels and business media is now spent on deciphering and interpreting the minutest of change in the Federal Reserve minutes or the Federal Reserve statements which come out. I mean, you have got analysts who are basically comparing the last Federal Reserve minutes to the present Federal Reserve minutes, and then they highlight within those paragraphs which words have changed. And that is the level of scrutiny which the Federal Reserve statements and commentary, you know, take from people today. So it's unfortunate. People, they talk less about companies, businesses, fundamentals, cash flows, profits, balance sheet. That is what we value investors love to focus on. It's unfortunately become more a game of trying to predict what the Federal Reserve will do next. But I simply tell people this, that, you know, I'll give you a very good, very, very good data point here. From December 1964, 31st December 1964 to 31st December 1981, the Dow Jones Industrial Average went up from 874 to 875. One single point move in 17 years.
But that was an exciting roller coaster, right?
Yet, Warren Buffett compounded his wealth at 20% CAGR over those 17 years when the market gave zero. So what does this tell me? That, you know, it's all about bottom-up stock picking. You know, all this, you know, noise about, you know, war happening in some country, oil price shocks, interest rate movements, what the Federal Reserve is saying, geopolitical concerns, political regime shifts, new political parties coming to power. There's so much noise. And this noise has become even more amplified in the age of social media. And just by having a clarity of thought and a stable mindset, just by being sensible, that itself gives you such a big advantage in today's world, just by being sensible. I think, you know, I should, you know, a good title for, you know, for a future book which should be written is Be Sensible Investor. Because it is just, that is all that investing has boiled down to now. Just be sensible. Don't pay too much attention to the noise. I mean, I'll give you one more example. So between March 2000 and March 2013, the NASDAQ for 13 long years gave zero return, zero. Yet there were certain technology stocks during those 13 years which gave very good returns. So don't focus on the index. You're not investing in an index fund. You're an active fund manager. So, you know, just focus on buying good stocks at good prices and then hold on to them as both these conditions are, you know, are being fulfilled. As business has to be good and the price has to make sense to you. If either of them go for a toss, then you just sell the stock and move on to the next opportunity, which is unnecessarily complicated investing too much, unfortunately. Just, I don't know, just I think it's very counterproductive, but then that is just making it sound more complex than it really is. It's what captures eyeballs and attention. And it can sell a lot of newsletters, but it cannot generate wealth for your clients.
Well, it immediately makes me think, and looping back to what we talked about, if a lot of people are very short-term focus and wasting a lot of energy and attention on the wrong things, as you mentioned, comparing notes from different Fed meetings. And there are others that actually look at the businesses, find the right businesses, patiently buy them, and have the conviction to hold on to them. Those will get compensated. And also related to that, it makes me think, and I don't disagree, that you're not a fan of passive investing, are you?
Well, I won't say I'm I'm not a fan, but yeah, I think for people who want to keep costs low and who do not know anything about investing, index funds are a good place to start. From there, you can graduate to directly managed mutual funds. And then you can opt for good active fund managers separately through a hedge fund structure or some private funds. But you have to follow a trajectory. Just don't jump into, you know, the most advanced form of investing in the very beginning. You know, just invest in index funds, then in mutual funds, and then active fund managers. You know, just keep learning along the way. The day you feel confident enough to invest on stocks on your own, then you can start building your own personal portfolio.
To me, it's all about the context. So I see at least two different situations. One, where somebody is investing a little bit every month, sort of a Kaizen method of $100 or $50 or whatever you can afford each month and putting it to the market, then passive investing starts to make sense because you don't have to know too much, but you're participating in the success of the businesses that are available out there. And you're averaging out your purchases over time. So you don't have to think about if it's a market low, market high, expensive, not expensive, because the amount that you put in will be spread out over a long period of time. Now, the challenges that we have very often is that you sit down with a client that either inherited a substantial amount of wealth or received it through a sale of business or a very successful career, and somebody's sitting with a large amount of money. Putting all of that money blindly at any point in time fully in a passive index fund is a very different proposition than putting $100 every month over your lifetime. Would you agree?
Fully agree. I'm a big proponent of dollar cost averaging because the beauty of that system of dollar cost averaging is that it helps you buy more units and more quantity of stocks in a bear market and in bad markets, and it lowers the quantity in expensive markets or bull markets. So it works very nicely over time.
Very much so. You say something in your book that I don't think I read anywhere else, and I agree with you wholeheartedly. You say something about borrowing other people's ideas. And you can say you can borrow someone's idea, but you can't borrow their conviction. Can you talk more about it? There's a lot of talk about cloning other people's ideas. And I personally can't say that I ever really cloned on somebody's idea. I always did my own work because for me to have enough of a conviction to stay with the name, that's not something I can borrow. And you describe it in your book, and I think it's the first time anybody described it this way to me. So tell me more about that.
It is absolutely fine to be aware of the investment choices of investors we admire and respect, but we should always do the necessary study at our end and pull the buy trigger only if the concerned business falls within our circle of competence and offers a good margin of safety. And personally speaking, the real joy and thrill of investing for me comes from the underlying research and discovery process. When you blindly clone someone else's stock picks without doing any due diligence, you forego the very aspect that makes investing such an intellectually satisfying activity. Also, one's conviction in a stock idea is reflected in the size of his allocation to it. Anyone can identify a winning stock, but the great investors differentiate themselves through superior individual position sizing. So you can borrow someone's idea, but you will never be able to borrow his conviction.
Very much so. And conviction is something that comes with time. And it's not that you have to spend a lot of time, but you have to do the right amount of research and understanding to develop conviction. And you talked about courage. To me, it's really interesting how we can all have access to the same knowledge, but we may not all develop the same conviction. And at the end of the day, we may not all have the same courage to buy or even hold on to an idea. And I think those three different concepts coexist in an interesting way. So the knowledge is one, so that you know that somebody that you admire has bought something. Conviction is something that you have to earn and develop on your own. And then the courage, that's something that has to come to you, that you will actually act on it and you will know how long you should hold it, if you should hold it. It's really interesting because just that somebody prints out a list of somebody else's holdings, unless you really copy everything they do, everything else might get you in trouble. That's how I look at it. But that's just my personal take on it. Gautam, I'm curious about India. You specialize in that market, and correct me if I'm wrong, but right now that's the only place where you're investing?
Yes, so I've got an India-focused fund.
And can you tell me more about the market, the opportunity, the depth of the market, and what you're seeing, what's possible, without mentioning any specific investment ideas, but just in very broad terms, why do you find it appealing? Why do you think it's attractive?
There is a saying which goes, no force on earth can stop an idea whose time has come. And in my view, India's time has arrived. It took India nearly 60 years to reach its first $1 trillion in GDP, but only 7 years to reach its second $2 trillion of GDP. And these subsequent trillions are expected to be reached in faster succession. If we simply assume the market cap to GDP to remain around 1 in the long run, one can just envisage the kind of wealth creation that lies in store for investors in the great Indian businesses, trillions of dollars. And this in turn will have a positive multiplier effect on the prosperity of the nation. Now, I have a simple overarching belief that makes me joyfully average upward in the great businesses that I own in India through my fund. Over the coming decades, trillions of dollars are going to be added to India's GDP. And if we simply assume the market cap to GDP to approximate 1 over time, what is going to happen in this case? The nation's best managed companies with proven ability to scale up operations will capture the bulk of this upcoming wealth creation boom in the Indian stock market. And it is my personal firm conviction and belief that all investors should definitely have some allocation to Indian equities in their personal portfolios for the next few decades. One should simply not miss out on such a great opportunity for long-term wealth creation. And that is the thought process with which I have established my India fund in the US to bring the great India investment opportunity to investors in this country.
Well, it sounds like it's a long-term growth opportunity. It's just, where do you go? What do you buy? And it looks like you have the expertise to find the right ideas. I'm curious about books. If you would share any books, and you shared one or two in this conversation, obviously your book is an incredible resource, and I'll include all the details in the notes. But are there any books that stand out that I always think of? if you were stranded on an island for 5 years, which books would you take with you?
Let me share 3 investing books and 3 non-investing books with you. As far as investing books go, Investing for Growth by Terry Smith taught me how to invest in quality businesses for the long run. You Can Be a Stock Market Genius by Joel Greenblatt taught me how to invest in various special situations like open offers, delistings, promoter management change, spin-offs, etc. And Capital Returns, edited by Edward Chancellor, taught me how to invest in cyclical businesses using the capital cycle theory. For non-investing books, I would highly recommend Seeking Wisdom by Peter Bevelin, More Than You Know by Michael Morbison, and Poor Charlie's Almanac, which has been edited by Pete Kaufman. These 3 are great books on multidisciplinary thinking. An additional bonus book recommendation is All I Want to Know is Where I'm Going to Die, So I'll Never Go There, written by Peter Bevelin. It's a great book on the principle of inversion, or knowing what not to do in life and in investing.
I love it. Peter Bevelin wrote a few books that are really remarkable. And the last one you mentioned, I haven't actually read it. It's on my list. But I imagine that given his other books that I found really interesting, I'm sure it's a wonderful read. And the whole idea of not going where you're going to die, I think it's Munger's words. I always look at the investment process of how can I avoid losing money, and all the upside will always take care of itself. And you also mentioned it in the book. You want to say a few words before we wrap it up in terms of avoiding mistakes and letting the upside take care of itself, because too many investors are focusing on the upside and forgetting about how they can get in trouble.
True. It's been often said that investing is a negative art, which what that basically means is knowing what not to do is far more important in investing than knowing what to do. So if you simply avoid the stupid mistakes, avoid the standard errors of human misjudgment, the upsides will take care of themselves, because the stock market is designed in such a way, it's a positive sum game. Capitalism works over the long run in basically getting all the incentives aligned to work for the capitalists and for wealth creation and value creation. With such a natural tailwind behind us, investing for the long term is a winner's game. And if we simply assume the future to be better than what it is today, then we'll automatically become an optimist. And if you are an optimist, like I tell people that, some people say that only optimists make money, or only optimistic people make money. But I tell people that only realistic people or realists make money in the long run. So be an optimistic realist. And that is the mindset to succeed in the market in the long run. Be always short-term cautious, but long-term positive, long-term optimistic. If you just do these 2 things, short-term paranoid, long-term optimistic, you'll have a very good investing career and investing journey in front of you.
It's about surviving. If you lose it all, you have to start from scratch. And Munger and Buffett say the last thing they want is to start from zero all over again. And there are so many famous names out there that lost billions and tens of billions in the last 3-5 years. So I always think that there's no amount of money that can be lost. And what Munger and Buffett teach us is sometimes it's not worth accepting certain risks, because starting from scratch is not worth it. Before we wrap up, I just wanted to say that we've been talking for an hour and a half, and neither of us mentioned benchmarks and outperformance, which which I love, and I'd like to leave it like that. But think about it. You talked about the inner scorecard, and I'm reminded of a recent conversation I had with somebody that was very fortunate to receive a substantial wealth for a sale of a business, and he's trying to figure out how to manage that wealth on his own. And he took a lot of my feedback, and he's just slowly learning. And I told him, imagine for a minute that nobody's looking. You're not comparing yourself to anybody. You're not trying to win any competition. You're not beating any benchmarks. How would you make decisions? And he paused and thought about it. And I really love that we've had this conversation about investing for an hour and a half. And you didn't bring up benchmarks. You didn't bring up outperforming. And I hope it's a lesson for everybody that wants to think about investing for the long run. Do we need the benchmarks to know where we're going? I'd like to say that we don't, but I'm curious about your thoughts.
I'll just state a quote from my book. In fact, it's very interesting you talked about this topic, because I've written a very salient quote in my book on this topic, which is that the only benchmark you need to care about is whether you are on track to reach your goals, which you set your portfolio up to achieve in the first place.
Exactly. That's it. And the benchmarks will come and go, but it's hard to manage money or to define your own success based on benchmarks. They're nice to have, but you need to have your own inner scorecard to know where you're going.
These benchmarks are just an unnecessary distraction in my view. I mean, you cannot eat relative returns. If the market is down 50% and you're down 40%, you cannot say that, you know, oh, I did a very good job. You just did not manage risk properly. So stop comparisons with others. Just focus on your individual journey, your client's welfare. Just keep things simple and you'll all do very well.
I love it. That's a beautiful way to close our conversation, Gautam. Thank you again. This was really wonderful. I learned a lot, and I recommend your book to everybody that's curious about investing and any stage of their career or their own pursuits. And again, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. This was a very good pleasure. I learned a lot as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
You were listening to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment and follow, subscribe, rate, and share with friends and family. We rely on word of mouth to promote the show. One click for you means the world to us. Thank you. Until next time, your host, Bogumil Baranowski. The content of this podcast is for general informational purposes only, and so are the opinions of members of Seekard Associates, a registered investment advisor, and guests of the show. This podcast does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any specific security or financial instruments, or provide investment advice or service. Past performance is not indicative of future results. More information on Seekard Associates is available in its Form ADV disclosure documents available at advisorinfo.sec.gov.